This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Let's follow up a little bit on Gary Oldman. We had the conversation leading up to the Oscars, and definitely Monday following when Gary Oldman won the Best Actor for Churchill. And you had the information, which had been out there before, but came up again when his ex-wife had accused him of physical abuse in a very specific, serious way. The authorities did examine it. No charges were filed. But you had Gary Oldman winning. You had Kobe winning. Kobe, of course, was accused of rape and went to court. A settlement was reached. There was a lot of talk about the ring that Kobe bought for his wife, the criticism that he took for a while and then embraced mainly by the basketball world and everybody else. And the idea was, what's going on here? What Me Too is this? Is this hypocrisy? And we had the conversation. Well, should the Academy factor that in? Is that fair when it's including individuals who've been charged and found guilty? Or is it different here if individuals have faced very serious allegations, but no charges have been filed? So Gulliver Oldman is Gary Oldman's son, and he has chimed in on this publicly. He is 20 at this time. So let's factor this in, Adam and Lindsay. So he's 20 right now. This incident involving his mother and his father took place in 2001. So he is 3 or 4 at the time. And he writes about this. It has been troubling and painful to see that these false allegations against my father being written about again, especially after this was settled years and years ago. My father is my one and true guiding light, my only hero. He is the man I aspire one day to become. If I could become only half as great and half as pure, I was granted the good graces of fatherhood as a child to be raised by him and only him. For that, I'm eternally grateful every hour of every day. I owe him the world, and I owe him my life. It appears the publicity speaking ill of my mother is something I'm either fond of or accustomed to. That is not the case. She has been a sad and very troubled person most of her life. Yes, she brought me into this world. She didn't, however, teach me to be a part of it. This lie and all her lies, things that she has perpetuated and living with as her truth, all of this has brought about so much pain and hardship for my father and for all of us, his family, united. My brother and I have both played a role of the pawn on numerous occasions throughout our lives, in a big game our mother has been desperately trying to play against our father. On all such occasions, the only retort my father has had is the truth. Always and thankfully so, the truth is on his side. Being a fully supporter of this movement, he's talking about the Me Too movement, I can see how coming out with a statement to combat an allegation must look. However, I was there at the time of the incident, so I'd like to make this radiantly clear. It didn't happen, and when it says it did, is lying. So we had this conversation the other day, Lindsay, about it. And again, I don't know what happened. I know what the ex-wife says. I know what Gary Oldman says. And I don't know what the son. You brought up the ex-wife's friends who backed it up. Does this change your view anyway at all on this story and how the Academy Award handles it and how we take in stories like this?
Well, it changes my viewpoint on what the relationship might have been. I don't know if I necessarily, you know, a 3 or 4 year old remembering an incident is not necessarily like concrete ground to completely dismiss what is being said.
Correct.
But I do appreciate him shining a little bit of light on what the relationship has been like since then between his mother and his father. It's tough. I mean, it's tough. It's tough that so many years went by where nothing was really said. It's tough that Gary hasn't been very forthcoming on it, except for saying that it didn't happen. But if he, you know, we've all dealt with people who have mental issues that make them behave in a way that is manipulative. And some of the things that the son is saying sounds like characteristics his mother might have.
Yeah. If he's telling the truth, again, right?
I
don't know. Right?
Yeah, you don't know that maybe, I mean, all the things that he's been able to have in life because of his father's success, what that plays a role in it, it's just, you don't know.
Right. I mean, that is the thing, Adam, and we've talked about this so many times because the power of the Me Too movement is fantastic in so many ways that so many people finally have a voice and a vehicle to speak out. But how do you deal with it? If potentially, again, I don't know if Gary Oldman's telling the truth. I don't know if the son's telling the truth. I don't know if the mom. But if you're trying to respond to this and you're still caught up in the wave of so many men acted so horrible and people looked away, how do you try to position yourself? It's still a very daunting road to travel, right?
Exactly. Yes. I mean, if you come right out and say, you know, I didn't do this. I mean, if so many... And I know we've said that this is part of the problem and why many women feel intimidated to come forward in the first place.
Yeah,
but it's a situation where we find the pendulum swings so far over one way that you hear rumors about something, then it's automatically, well, it must be true, and so many people, without even reading the details of what is alleged to have happened or maybe what the history is,
because of so many others, just
they'll
assume.
Just jump on and say, oh, they assume that there's a problem here and that something must have happened. That's why I hadn't paid that close attention to Gary Oldman's history, but I knew nothing of this until
the last few days. Yeah, probably a lot of people that way. 2:10, here's Adam. So many times we've talked about football, brain injuries, kids, what states should do, what families should do. How about this one, Adam and Lindsay? This involves a family where the parents are divorced and there is a differing view. The father, John Orsini, he's gone to court to prevent the youngest of the 3 sons from playing high school football because he cites the scientific studies on the perils of, the problems with playing football. There is a different view, though. He is 66. Just give a little background on him. Always has been an enthusiastic supporter of football. Big Steelers guy from the area. He enrolled his sons in youth tackle football when they were as young as 5, including his youngest son. He said he attended the practices and games for years, even after he and his ex-wife Janice divorced in 2004. Their oldest son, Giuseppe, is 21. He plays football at Case Western University. But his view of the game, Orsini says, changed when his youngest son, now 17, sustained 3 sports-related concussions. The first was in 2013, when he was hit in the head with a metal baseball bat while not wearing a helmet. Second and third concussions were during football games, and he said that was when things changed. He said he has tried unsuccessfully to discuss with his wife, ex-wife, on stopping this. The ex-wife declined to be interviewed, but her lawyer said she considered her son, now a junior in high school, mature enough to understand the risk of the game and to make up his own mind. She felt reassured that her son's coaches were well-trained at spotting and caring for concussed players. They have legal joint custody. Okay, and Ms. Orsini's attempts to block their sons from playing football, according to Ms. Orsini, amounted to one parent acting unilaterally. There's got to be a shared situation. So then legally they battled this. In late July, just before his son was to start practicing for his junior season, the father told his school that he did not want his son playing, that he had joint legal custody. The superintendent said, I cannot speak to an individual student's circumstance, but generally in custody disputes, the terms are spelled out and we follow them. The case then moved to family court. In early August, Janice Orsini filed an emergency request to let her son play, as he has for more than a decade. Mr. Orsini argued that while he had supported the son's right to play for years, he was now aware of new information. The judge allowed the ban to stand. So far, the kid's not playing. But 2 weeks later, Janice Orsini filed a petition to gain sole legal custody related to the child's participation in extracurricular activities. The judge agreed to let the boy resume playing while she decided on whether to approve the change of the custody order. Despite numerous motions over the next few months, the father was unable to persuade the judge to stop the son from playing, and the boy completed his junior season. They're now having mediation. Two sides are no close. And it's getting the point now, because it's going to drag on until November when his son will turn 18, and then it doesn't matter. I mean, Adam, think about this one, right? And divorced parents can disagree on a lot of different things. And it can depend legally on how it's spelled out. But when you're now talking about safety of kids, participation, and when there's a shared decision on how you arrive at these decisions because of whatever the agreement you worked out or you worked out to the courts, how you arrive at this is tough. And we were talking before about the iPad thing and breaking. Well, the age matters here. How much should it matter to you, Adam, that we're now dealing with the safe 17-year-old? 18, it's over, right? Then he gets to decide. But how much should it matter now if the pattern is clear that he is a 17-year-old, he's played for a while, he's had three concussions, the research is out there.
Still a minor.
He's still a minor.
Still a minor. First of all, this is a custody dispute that's the football is just a byproduct of, personally, because a mom and dad who obviously can't get together and put the health of their son before anything else.
Well, they can, but they just see it differently.
Well, they can see it differently, but they're get a doctor involved. So the kid's had three concussions, and if I'm the mother or the father, I've got real concerns, okay? If he wants to play football again, he's already had three concussions at 17. This is 1 year too. Okay, next year you're a senior. Now you're an adult. You can make your own decision. But I would think that somewhere along the line, whether it be a judge or even the parents could put their heads together and say, okay, you know what? Let's take the kid to a doctor, or maybe even if one doctor's opinion isn't enough, maybe two, who says, you know what?
What if you get two different doctors' opinions? Because I get what you're saying.
I go to a third. I mean,
because it sounds to me like you're saying three's enough, he shouldn't play. Is that what you're saying?
Well, at least, I mean, to have enough concerns that maybe he shouldn't play.
But I don't know if she's saying she's not concerned.
Well, I'm sure she is, but you're also playing the emotions that your kid wants to play football too. But
it is a legal matter, right? Because, Lindsay, it's 50-50. So at what point as a 17-year-old does he get input? But then when would you step in and say, listen, you're 17, you're not 27. You are potentially jeopardizing your health. And in this case, as dad, it could be the bomb either way. I'm trying to help you and you're not listening.
I think Adam's spot on with his concept that there is a lot of animosity between mom and dad. And I don't doubt that the mom has her son's best interests at heart. But it unfortunately, from what I've read, seems like she's using the son's stance to better herself in this arrangement. And it is unfortunate that he's 17, you know, that he likes to play, that he's had these concussions. If it were a custody dispute, from what I've seen, now granted, I know every case is different, a 17-year-old would be able to give input to the judge about which parent he wanted to live with. So a 17-year-old should be given some sort of responsibility when it comes to what he's doing. The unfortunate part is that it is such, I mean, three concussions, and he wants to continue to keep playing.
It's a hard one because we got to separate, Adam, our own view of when is it too risky?
Well,
okay, versus now, what role the courts play legally and how the school deals with that. Because it's a shared situation.
It's a shared situation, and I would be very interested to see how the reaction would change if the roles of the mom and dad were reversed.
Plus,
if the father was pro football, I want him to play,
yeah, right?
And the mother was more.
Perceptually, there would be some difference
about it. Absolutely. The fact that it's the mother who's saying, no, 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 this is what he wants to do.
Yep.
We're fine. And it's the father. I mean, kudos to the dad, because I think there are a lot of people who would not take it to this extent. But kudos to him for not backing down.
Well, the top text, too, saying about how many schools having restrictions. I can't believe that either, that if that a high school football program, if a kid has had three documented concussions, that there wouldn't be some sort of restrictions on that kid playing. And these days,
yeah,
now in these days, especially with how careful schools are.
Right. And they're so much better now than they have been. Right. It is an interesting one because you're taking this one on its own. Can you look at other precedent and how do you make that decision? And is the kid old enough? And do you sometimes say, well, you're 17, but you're jeopardizing your health over this particular situation?
Well, I think if you asked any adult about something that their parents gave them the decision to make when they were 16, 17, 18 years old, and their parents maybe said, I don't think that's the right decision, but you're almost an adult, I'm going to let you make it. I think there are a ton of us that would look and we would say, we made the wrong decision.
Or there might be plenty would say, when they're 16, 17, 18, they wanted to play it, their parents said no, and it still bugs them. It still absolutely bothers them. That they didn't have it.
That pickleball championship could have been yours.
Could have been racquetball when it was booming after the movie Splash. Well, an interview with a guest on universal basic income. This man who's in his early 50s, has shown an interest in universal basic income since he was 15 years old. So he's going to join us after traffic, weather, news. This is a legitimate story. This is out of Tarrant County, Texas. Defendants are sometimes strapped to a stun belt around their legs. In this case, Terry Lee Morris, the device was used as punishment for refusing to answer a judge's question properly during a 2014 trial on charges of soliciting sexual performance from a 15-year-old girl. Obviously a horrible charge he's facing. No one's trying to defend the allegation he's facing. The judge, Adam and Lizzie, shocked him three times, sending thousands of volts coursing through his body. The action stunned the Texas 8th Court of Appeals. It's now thrown out the conviction on the grounds that the shocks and Morris's removal from the court violated his constitutional rights. The ruling was handed down at the end of February. It's just a typical stun belt. Here's how it played out. So you have Morris and you have the judge. Judge Gallagher, okay? The judge says, how are you going to plead? Guilty or not guilty? Sir, before I say that, I have a right to make a defense. He had recently filed a lawsuit against his defense attorney and against the judge, whom he wanted to recuse from the case. The judge said, Mr. Morris, I'm giving you one warning. You will not make any additional outbursts like that because two things will happen. Number one, I will either remove you from the courtroom. I will use the shock belt on you. All right, sir, Morris said. The judge continued. Are you now going to follow the rules? Morris, again, the individual who's facing the charges, sir, I've asked you to recuse yourself. The judge asked again, are you going to follow the rules? I have a lawsuit pending against you. Adam, the judge then says, hit him. And the bailiff pressed a button which shocks Morris. Gallagher asked him again whether he's going to behave. Morris told Gallagher he had a history of mental illness, hit him again. Morris protested that he was being tortured, and Gallagher asked the bailiff, would you hit him again? Adam, this isn't from like 40 years ago, 50 years ago. This happened in 2014. That's what we're doing now. This guy could be a horrible person. I have no idea. He could be soliciting young kids, and I would want him to face the furthest extent of the law that could. But this is what we're doing when someone doesn't answer the questions right. We're putting a stun belt on him, and we have a judge who thought this was appropriate and this would last. This is pathetic. This isn't being soft on crime. This is you have the opportunity to defend yourself in front of jurors, judge, and then you have an attorney and you face the proper process. And if you're not answering the questions properly, you're taken out and you face further sanctions. We're not sending jolts of pain through you if you don't answer questions appropriately to the judge. You're shocked by this, or you're not surprised that this is going on?
I didn't even know these belts existed, to be honest. And again, yeah, you may say leave what you think about the guy aside, but doesn't seem like proper legal procedure to me.
It's despicable. Lindsay, what if this was think about how big of a story it would be if this was happening here in our state.
I think it's probably more common than we want to admit. And I think that there are...
You think there are a number of judges around the country who are using a stun belt when defendants aren't answering questions, right?
Probably. I mean, we have a serious problem in this country with people who are put into positions of power and how they abuse it.
Well, that's true. I would love to see some good reporting, because if this is commonplace, this is outrageous. And this is, before I get the first text, you're soft. I'm not. If he's doing this... Send him away, whatever the law says. And if the laws aren't strong enough in Texas, make them stronger. But a judge shouldn't be allowed to use a stun belt as his little toy to punish people. Chad Hartman back here with you on WCCO. The conversation on universal basic income has come up a number of times, including recently with some polling numbers, which are rather interesting. That's why Lindsay reached out to a very good guest on this topic, Carl Weiderquist. He is an American political philosopher, and he's an economist, at Georgetown University Qatar, and he has followed this for a long, long time. Carl, thanks for your time. Am I right in this, that you've been drawn to this ever since you were a teenager? Is that correct?
Yes, I was. That's true. I first heard about it when Milton Friedman talked about it on his television show Free to Choose back in 1980. I'm no longer a big fan of Milton Friedman, but... I really appreciate what he said about the basic income, or he called it the guaranteed income.
So you can lay this out better than I. So just for folks who are not familiar with universal basic income, what is the best way to describe it and how it would work here in the United States?
It's simply a way of putting a floor under everybody's income so that nobody has to be destitute, nobody has to be homeless, no child has to grow up in poverty. It is merely a market economy where income doesn't have to start at zero. The punishment for not being productive doesn't have to be that we kick you out and throw you on the street. We don't have to threaten people with such horrible deprivation to get them to work. Our incentive to get people to work should be positive incentive, should be good wages. A good pay, good working conditions, so that you're much better off working. And if you do that, you don't have to have a society that runs on the threat of really deep and life-threatening poverty.
I'm looking at a story where you're cited, and you say you remember a poll about a decade ago where support at the time for universal basic income was a little over 10%. And now it's just short of 50%. Why has the support increased so dramatically in your view?
Well, I would say that there are a whole bunch of different reasons and a bunch of different people coming together at the same time on this issue. And I would say maybe two main ones. One is that people are realizing since the Great Recession and the Great Financial meltdown of 2008-2009, that inequality, waking up to the fact that inequality has been getting worse since the 1970s. We were doing something about inequality in the 50s and 60s and did a lot of good and lowered the poverty rate quite a bit after having lowered it quite a bit in the 30s and 40s. We saw so much progress. And then since the 1970s, not only has poverty not gone down anymore and inequality has gone up, but the middle class has not gotten a raise despite all the productivity that we've had. The typical worker in the middle has not gotten higher wages or fewer hours as they could. With all of the technical progress we made, we could all be getting paid more and working less, and we haven't had the opportunity to do that. And people have realized that cutting back on the welfare state is not good for the middle class because it puts us in a position where we're dependent on our employers. And the people who are now looking at this are not, they don't want to rebuild Lyndon Johnson's welfare state. They want something that works better. And that's what basic income is. I think that is the main reason that's turning people to basic income now.
Let me get
the other main reason, I think, has to do with automation. Yeah, you want to follow up there before I go to automation?
Yeah, let me just get you to react to what Robert Greenstein had to say. He is the president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He is saying, yeah, by his estimates, a program providing everyone with $10,000 annually would cost $3 trillion a year. And he added, to me, universal basic income is a beautiful pie-in-the-sky idea, but I don't see it ever getting beyond that pie-in-the-sky idea. So in your ideal world, are you saying every single citizen would get said figure, and what would that figure be, as opposed to, let's say, you're below some sort of income level, and you would get it and others would not?
What that person is saying is really highly disingenuous. You give the basic income to everyone, but it doesn't cost any more to give the basic income to everyone than it does to give it just to the people who are what we would call net recipients. Because when you are, what you have in a basic income is this one thing that Milton Friedman said that was descriptive, is a basic income is a negative tax. When you're going to give everybody a basic income, but you're also going to raise taxes to pay for it. When a negative tax meets a positive tax, they cancel each other out. And so for people at upper incomes, you're going to give them a basic income of $10,000, and then you're going to raise their taxes by more than $10,000.
But why? Let me jump in just so we can go back and forth. Let me just jump in.
What costs them is the difference between the two.
Respectfully, so let me just jump in here so we can get to a few of these points in a relatively short amount of time. Why should someone who has been successful on her own or his own, who's making, let's say, $1 million, let's just make it an easy figure, why should they get an additional $10,000 from the federal government?
Well, you do that because it is good for, you give to those who already have a lot, because that is the best way to get it to everyone. If you try to give it just to those who have low income, then every day you have to figure out who has low income. We do that once a year with our taxes. To do it on a daily basis is really hard. If a woman has to leave her husband, if you have a basic income, then it's there. If she's running out on her husband that's abusing her wife or her children, the basic income is there from day one. If it is something else, then she has to go and apply, and then she has to get accepted, and we have to take forever to find that out. So it is worth it to give it to everyone for this reason, and it doesn't cost any more. What it costs is, what is the increased overall tax burden on those who are net contributors? And what is the net benefit to those who are net recipients? You have to subtract what they're paying in taxes from what they get in the basic income. And that's where you find out the real benefit and burdens of this program.
Okay, so let me pick up on that. Remind folks, we're talking to Carl Widerquist, American political philosopher. He is an economist at Georgetown University, Qatar. He's been involved in basic income, universal basic income, since he's a kid. He's spoken out on this for decades. So you are saying, do you agree with the premise that to give everybody $10,000, we're talking $3 trillion? So then are you then saying we're going to have to raise taxes in equal of $3 trillion?
No, it does not cost $3 trillion. The net cost of a $12,000 basic income is actually $539 million. You're talking about a gross cost, which doesn't really mean anything. If you were to calculate other negative taxes in the same way that this person is calculating this cost, you'd have to say that the standard tax deduction costs trillions of dollars. That little standard tax deduction that we all get on our taxes, you'd have to say that costs trillions of dollars.
So are you saying, sir, respectfully, are you saying to give every single citizen in America $12,000, we're only going to have to raise taxes for $539 million? That you're an economist. You know this 1,000% better than me. But to me, that those numbers don't seem to add up.
Yeah, well, it is actually $12,000 for an adult and $6,000 per child.
Okay. But
you can do that for $539 million. And that $539 means that those who pay more in taxes than they receive in basic income, their burden will go up by $539 million nationwide. Their total burden, what they pay in taxes minus what they get in basic income, goes up by only $539 million, 2.95% of GDP. That's all it is, and that's enough to eliminate poverty in the United States.
Where has this been tried, and where has it been successful?
Well, it has been tried. The closest thing that exists right now is in Alaska, where they have a dividend from a fund created from oil revenue. That's been in place for 35 years, and it's an extremely popular program. Now, other things are not exactly like basic income, but are moving in the direction. Social Security in the United States, you get that once you're retired, you get that whether or not you have other income. It goes to every single person who has met the eligible criteria early in their life. That works more like a basic income than pensions in a lot of other places. In Britain, people are always complaining about how terrible their pension system is, and people in the United States, because ours is more like a basic income. Food stamps are sort of like a basic income, except you can only use them for approved purchases. The earned income tax has some similarities to basic income because it's in cash. And you find that these programs that are moving in the direction of basic income are often work much better than things like public housing or unemployment insurance that don't work as much like basic incomes and cause other problems. You get on unemployment insurance, you're really afraid to take. Sometimes you're afraid to take your next job because then you won't be eligible if the job turns out to be terrible.
Carl, I enjoyed the conversation. It obviously is a topic that has resonated with a lot of people since there's almost a 50-50 divide on it. I appreciate your time. And when the topic comes up again, if you're so willing, we'd love to have you on again. Thank you so much.
Hey, great talking to you.
Carl Weiderquist, American political philosopher, economist at Georgetown University, Qatar, and a man who believes in universal basic income. I know texts are coming in. You want to react, you certainly can. 81807. We're back in moments on WCC. Lindsay has her Pat Benatar hair going today. Very impressive. Tomorrow, we're going to spend some time talking to Lindsay about what yesterday was like after work, because it was a rather important day in her life. We're going to get to that tomorrow. We've got an extended period of time. Among the texts coming in, this is the dumbest idea I've ever heard of. Giving $12,000 every U.S. adult will encourage more people to exit the workforce. Talking about Alaska, and that's earned income compared to how he was explaining. I think he did, though. This guy's full of you-know-what. Communist, socialist. I'll say this. According to the poll, there were 24% of Republicans agree with this idea, which surprised me a lot. I can't see it happening, but the conversation is definitely out there. I still will be shocked if it does take place. Linda's construction time check is 257. Time to learn why Linda's has served over 75,000 happy customers since 1979. Enjoy the rest of the day.